We'll call court to session.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is December 15, 2021. We have four cases on our calendar this morning. We are here on our second case, A210340. Please correct me if I mispronounce your client's names. Bienemann versus Bienemann. And again, correct me if I mispronounce their names. Counsel, we've had some technical difficulties this morning, so I appreciate your patience with us. We didn't have any technical difficulties during our first argument, and hopefully that will continue. If we do, we will contact you separately to get you back on the screen if we experience any challenges. But we thank you for your patience as we work through those this morning. A few housekeeping matters before you begin your argument. Please mute your microphone if you are not speaking. The marshal is showing a running clock of your time. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and the appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. I'd ask that each of you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking. And with that, counsel, we are ready to go.
Good morning, Your Honor, and thank you. May it please the court, Michael Boulette here on behalf of appellant Yelena Bienemann. Your Honors, more than 20 years ago, Ms. Bienemann moved halfway around the world to marry, to serve as a homemaker and caretaker for her husband. At the end of that long-term marriage, she walked away with 4% of the party's combined assets, less spousal maintenance than the district court found she needed and that her husband could pay, and tens of thousands of dollars in legal debt. And so we've appealed assigning error to three principal items that I hope to address in turn today. First, and frankly foremost, the calculation of Mr. Bienemann's non-marital interests. Those are legal issues that this court reviews de novo, and there are three independent legal errors that we'll touch on in turn. Secondarily, the award of less spousal maintenance than the court found Ms. Bienemann to need and found her husband could pay without any findings to explain that discrepancy. And third, and lastly, the failure to make a mandatory award of need-based legal fees to Ms. Bienemann without any findings made by the district court. At the outset, I believe the non-marital issues here are in many ways the most legal, and the court is exercising a de novo standard of review as to the legal aspects of those non-marital claims. What the district court did, in essence, is to adopt verbatim respondents' proposed findings with respect to his non-marital interests. And that verbatim adoption of proposed findings contained three independent errors. First and foremost, it confused marital income, income from non-marital assets, but that is marital in character, with the corpus of a non-marital asset. Secondarily, it confused active marital appreciation in a home with non-marital appreciation. And third, it violated almost to the letter the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Antone versus Antone by failing to credit Ms. Bienemann with the portion of appreciation she would have been entitled to on her marital interest in the home. Now, the home really was the center of this trial dispute, and so it's an appropriate place to begin. The Supreme Court has made it clear that even if property is non-marital in the first instance, that non-marital character doesn't adhere when the parties expend marital effort or marital money to make improvements. And so the Supreme Court in the Faust decision, and then this court's decision in Dorweiler, made clear that when we calculate a non-marital interest to an asset that has had marital improvements done to it, the appropriate methodology is to subtract out the cost of those improvements. Those are the words Dorweiler uses. The cost of those improvements before we determine what non-marital interest may exist. That didn't happen here. We have clear and uncontroverted testimony at trial that there were $200,000 in improvements made to the Bienemann family home with marital money. Those improvements were actually part of Mr. Bienemann's exhibits. Both parties testified to them, and they were noted in the appraisal that was done of the marital home. And yet when the district court conducted its analysis, it made no mention of those improvements and failed to subtract them out before calculating any non-marital interest under Dorweiler. That's error. And it's black letter law error, as this court's decision in Dorweiler makes clear. Extending that error out, the district court said, I'm going to calculate whatever marital interest there is in this home by taking the mortgage balance at the time the home was acquired and the mortgage balance at the date of divorce, I should say the date of valuation before Mr. Binneman paid it down, and saying that that mortgage reduction, that's the marital component. And that's it. Nothing else, nothing more. The Supreme Court addressed that issue on all fours in the Antone case, in which a district court looked at non-marital real estate that had had a marital pay down over the course of the marriage and simply labeled that portion marital with nothing more. And what the Antone court described as the central error in that analysis is that it doesn't benefit or doesn't give the marital estate the benefit of appreciation on its investment, right? If the marital estate created, as according to the district court's findings, $30,000 in equity, then it also gets the proportionate share of appreciation as the home goes up in value over time. That didn't happen here. And we can see the court's error very clearly because it explains it to us in its findings. It says, I understand that there's a dispute in the value of the home, 650 versus 720. And really, it doesn't matter which of these appraisals I use because the marital interest is the same. That's exactly the logic that the Antone decision rejected. You cannot do that, Antone says. You always need to calculate a marital and non-marital interest by using the Schmitz formula that says what are proportions. And that what that Schmitz formula does without diving into the math is ensure that both parties gain the benefit of any marital appreciation. So that becomes our second legal error, right? First, we haven't distinguished the act of appreciation. Secondly, we violated Antone. Third, we failed to...
Mr. Boulay, before you go to the third one, I actually want to ask a threshold question. And that is, on these first set of issues that you were raising in terms of non-marital property, aren't these issues forfeited? Were they even raised below? So do we even need to consider them in the first instance?
You do need to consider them, Judge Reyes. All of the non-marital issues with respect to the home were fully litigated below. And in fact, this was the subject of the a significant portion of the Binneman's trial. Right? They went to trial over this question of what is Mr. Binneman's non-marital interest in the home? And Ms. Binneman said, absolutely, you do not have a non-marital interest in the home. And she gave any number of reasons for that. She disagreed as to the characterization of his inheritance. She believed those investments had been commingled. She cited both the application of the Schmitz formula as well as the improvements in her findings. So those issues on all fours were preserved. They were raised at trial. They were raised in Ms. Mineman's post-trial submissions, which she did pro se.
I understand that her 98-page submission that she submitted pro se, she did raise a Schmitz issue. But what about the issue, the very first issue that you're talking about in terms of in your brief with respect to income reinvested from the brokerage and retirement accounts?
Right. And I think, Your Honor, as to your question of the threshold issue on the first two, improvements to the home and appreciation in the home, those are preserved. As to the second issue regarding income in the home, in reviewing the transcript and reviewing the record, counsel for Ms. Binneman at trial did not raise that specific issue with the district court. We believe the court should still address it here for similar reasons that Jacobson talks about addressing issues, which is that it depends on no new or uncontroverted facts. In fact, many of the facts we're drawing on aren't credibility determinations. They accept as true Mr. Bieneman's exhibits. So this is information coming to us from respondent's case and exhibits. Secondarily, they are in many ways part and parcel of Mr. Bieneman's non-marital claim to the home. Part of how he gets to virtually all of this marital home is my non-marital property uses funds that flow through many of these Baird accounts. And so they are integral to how we understand that claim. And Your Honor, we will absolutely acknowledge that on the limited issue of interest in dividends on his brokerage accounts, that was not raised squarely below. And so we'd ask the court to view that claim with, I think the case law says, a generous eye, given Ms. Bieneman's pro se status after trial, and given the vast disparity in the party's resources for professional fees.
Also, you had raised the issue at the very beginning of your argument that she is left with only 4% of the party's income. I don't think that's actually an accurate statement, because you're, that statement is based on the non-marital assets that husband has. So
she's left with 4% of the overall estate. Right now, whether how you determine husband's interest determines as whether you think she got 50% of the marital estate, as the district court found, or whether you think she got far less than 50% of the marital estate, because the reality that the court made several different errors of law in how it calculated husband's non-marital interest. We raise that point to illustrate the compounding effect of those legal errors, right? That any one of those legal errors by itself, the court may say, particularly when we look at maintenance and attorney's fees, the court may say, well, on balance, is that enough? But the cumulative effect of each of these three errors results in one party to a 20-year marriage leaving with a very small amount of money and a few hundred dollars a month away from what the district court itself called being destitute, and another party walking away with several million dollars, no obligation for ongoing legal fees, and the benefit of a significant amount of property that was in fact marital as a matter of law.
But to be fair, though, the non-marital assets are assets that husband received from his mother. And those typically are considered non-marital assets, unless there is some commingling going on. But I'm not sure if it's really fair to say she's only receiving 4%, because even if we were to agree with you on all of the claims that you brought in, even if we were to say they're not forfeited or consider them, if they were forfeited, it's still not, in terms of the marital assets, the marital asset division is much closer. And I think the district court really tried to make sure that it was as close to being equitable as possible. And equitable doesn't mean 50-50, even on the marital assets.
Well, and Judge Reyes, I disagree with you there a little bit, and I disagree on two points. One, the district court actually didn't conduct an equitable analysis. It just did an equal analysis of what it found the marital estate to be. It found the marital estate to be X, and again, based on a number of legal errors that made that dwindled the value of the marital estate quite low, it then kind of recognized, so that would be the first point of disagreement, that the court didn't do an equitable division that in some ways favored Ms. Bienemann, recognizing her former spouse has far superior.
And let me just stop you there. What I said is I think the court tried to make an equitable. I understand that you dispute whether it in fact was. My point is I think the court tried to make an equitable distribution.
And perhaps, Your Honor, we don't actually see many findings of fact on that. And that goes to our fourth assignment of error, which is when we look at each of the factors in 518-58, those factors would be the sorts of factors that would cause us to depart from an equal division of assets and favor Ms. Bienemann for the sole reason that she's the spouse leaving after 20 years of caretaking responsibilities with very, very little. I would like to point in my final 3 minutes to the maintenance and the need-based legal fee errors. First, with respect to maintenance, what I think we have here is a clerical error. The district court, throughout its findings, says repeatedly, she needs $3,800, he can pay $3,800. $3,800 is what goes into the guideline child support calculator, $3,800, and then we get to the conclusions of law, and it's $35. Now, I'm not in the habit of appealing over $300 a month issues, and for Ms. Bienemann, this is a very real hardship. The district court found that a $465 a month child support obligation would impose a severe financial hardship, would render her, you know, potentially destitute. So that loss of $300 by clerical error has very real consequences to her. Now, the response and reply has been, she raised that in her motion to amend. The district court knew, and the district court's order shows a real lack of consideration of Ms. Bienemann's post-trial arguments, in which it says, I'm going to adopt husband's order, unprofessional though it may be, and if the Court of Appeals doesn't like it, they can tell me. So we do think that that's not an intentional error on the district court's part. We think it's clerical, but it has very real consequences for Ms. Bienemann. The final point would be need-based legal fees. Now, under 518.14, this is a mandatory award if each of the three factors is proven. It is because it is a mandatory award that this court said in Richards, district courts, before they deny a motion for legal fees, need to make findings, right? Particularly where the record as a whole would support an award here. And here we know the district court thought Ms. Bienemann had need right? It says she can't afford to even pay $400 a month in child support. It recognizes the vast disparity of assets. I don't think there's a reasonable dispute on this record. Husband could pay $20,000 in legal fees if requested. There is a dispute, and husband raises this in a reply, that were all of Ms. Bieneman's fees necessary for good faith assertion of her efforts? He disagrees, but the court made no findings on that issue. Court never found that there was a problem with what generated Ms. Bieneman's $20,000 in legal fees as compared to her husband's $100,000 in fees. And so under Richards, we would remand and ask the district court to make findings on that issue and determine whether in fact need-based fees are appropriate. So taken as a whole, Your Honor, what we're seeking remand on are the calculation of Mr. Bieneman's non-marital interests to exclude those things, those items that as a matter of law are marital, active appreciation, improvements to the home, market-based appreciation, as well as the accrual of income, as well as what we believe to be a clerical error in the amount of maintenance awarded and the failure to make findings and award need-based legal fees on a record that could have undoubtedly supported them. And with that, I will reserve the remainder of our time for reply.
Thank you very much, counsel. We're going to reset the clock, Mr. Schiff. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. The first issue, and Judge Reyes addressed this, is our position is a lot of this was not raised below. And I want to start off by saying Mr. Bieneman is not arguing that Yelena Bieneman had to disprove his non-marital claims. But one of the big sore spots was she didn't even respond to Jeffrey. She cites in her page 8 of her reply brief, and I think it's deceptively, that says she cites to the court saying that Ms. Bieneman objected and needed to know what the marital claims were before she could respond. And that's not true. If you read the transcript that they cite, the court was not stating that as a fact. It was asking a question of me, Mr. Benneman's counsel. More importantly, Ms. Bieneman had all the information for Bill's non-marital claims and the supporting documents going back to September of 2019, about 9 months before the trial. She chose not to respond to discovery, and she chose not to disclose the facts that supported her denial of non-marital claims. Then she, in addition to, in a civil case, a plaintiff has a burden, but a defendant still has to respond to discovery. Ms. Bieneman didn't do that. She didn't provide any of these claims, so we went to trial without the benefit of knowing what her arguments would be, and now she's on her sixth lawyer, who is now raising arguments that her previous lawyers did not raise. So she tries to make up for her failure to address these things by citing to her testimony on page 8 of her reply brief, where she cites her own testimony. But if you look at it, it's mostly she's talking about like a one sentence statement where she says Bill's non-marital interest in the house is $170,000 without any further elaboration. That doesn't raise the issue of Bill's tracing and whatnot. She also cites to her contributions to the house as being washing windows, sewing for the child in the house, and performing other unidentified tasks. Again, those don't raise the issue. They don't preserve the issues. She also cites to her testimony regarding Mr. Benneman's BMO accounts, again, without any elaboration. Keep in mind, the BMO accounts were divided as of the valuation date. So we submit that her citation in her reply brief to her own testimony is a bait and switch, because if you read the testimony, she doesn't actually preserve these issues. And if you look at her post-trial findings, as well as her post-trial motion, I think Judge Reyes correctly pointed out, she does raise the Schmitz issue in passing. She doesn't get into it in detail. She actually says she should be awarded a portion of the $32,000 as it increased over time. So we're not talking about a lot of money regardless, but again, she raises it almost in passing after the fact. And counsel suggests that she was pro se, but 98 pages, I read that. Either she's a phenomenal pro se litigant or she had help. But again, she's on her sixth lawyer now. So again, she says that she should get more leeway because of the of her not having counsel. She had counsel at trial. She should not get a pass for failing to raise issues down below. As for the income from the non-marital inheritance, I think we've already addressed that. She didn't address it at trial. Again, there were some de minimis amounts referenced in the statements. We're only talking about a short period of time. But she also doesn't dispute that Mr. Benjamin kept his inherited assets separate, and that and it was only, again, about a year and a half before the trial, between the time that his mom passed away and he got the estate settled up, and then we had the valuation date less than a year and a half later. So we cite a case, Rannick versus Rannick, that the nothing was the product of investment decisions. It just was the market increase, and that should not convert it from non-marital to marital. As far as the homestead appreciation,
But Mr. Schiff, it appears that there are some issues. Really, I do speak English, and I know how to speak English. It appears that there's some issues here in terms of whether or not husband who has the burden to prove the lack of tracing of the non-marital assets, as well as the showing that they haven't been commingled, but also there appears to be issues here in terms of whether or not it's from passive appreciation or active management of non-marital funds, which can make them marital. For example, if they're used to improve a property, those can be considered then marital funds. So isn't there an issue here that the district court did not specifically address? It appears that the district court just assumed all the non-marital assets remained non-marital assets without taking a good hard look at whether or not they have been and whether or not applying the Schmitz formula. So why aren't those issues that the district court should take another look at?
Okay, well, I got to unpack that. There's a few different questions in there. Number one is the fact of the active versus a passive appreciation. The accounts, there's no indication that Mr. Benjamin was actively involved in managing his own accounts. These were inheritances from his mother. It was set up pursuant to a estate plan where the assets went from the mother to the son, and they went to very certain accounts, and then they remained in place. Again, we're only talking about a year and a half during which there could have been any investment, dividend, or interest income, but there's no evidence that.
But didn't a chunk of it go into their joint account, which means it was cash? Okay. And then it must have been reinvested. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, a transfer of that account right into husband's account, correct?
Okay, that's actually a separate asset. The ones that generated the income that he's referring to are from the Baird account, I believe. That was from the mother's IRA to the son's, I think, or investment. I don't remember the exact total, but what you're referring to is something separate. When there was an estate settle up in May of 2017, $505,000 went into the joint account. It wasn't supposed to, but it went in. Bill took some of that out and put it into his BMO account. And this relates to the payoff of the mortgage. The $505,000 went into the account. $125,000 went into his BMO account. Another $200,000 2 months later went to the BMO account. And he brought $125,000 back. Okay. $125,000 came back. And he used another 120 some thousand from the Baird account, and this is all in the record. It's in our brief. It's well documented. He took that money and he paid off the $242,000 mortgage. So he took 125 out of the 505, and he took another 120 from the Baird, and he paid off the mortgage. Keep in mind that he had another couple hundred thousand that remained. As you know, minus I think he bought one other thing of $30,000 or $40,000, but Miss Benjamin got the benefit of that difference because at the end of the day, when they were settling up in the BMO accounts, he didn't have that $500,000 left. He had paid part of it off for the mortgage, and he paid other things that she got the benefit of. So if you look at it from the standpoint of Miss Benjamin,
which she didn't really, because basically got the whole house. I mean, the equity in the house, except for $32,000, correct?
Correct. But keep in mind,
$200,000 was invested for improvements, and that was just kind of gone. I mean, that's, you know, which was a marital asset.
Well, okay. Again, we're talking about more. Okay, he had $505,000 and $125,000 came back to pay the mortgage, minus another, I think it's $30,000 to $50,000 that he spent on one other non-marital asset he was awarded. The rest of that is did not come back to him as a non-marital property. It was used for marital expenses and bills, including payments to appreciate the house or to improve the house. But getting back to the issue of the house.
Well, but that's while he was married, right? I mean, that's what you do in a marriage. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. But if it's non-marital property, whether you're married or not is not the point. The court can apportion some of the non-marital property to the other side. This district court chose not
if it's used for marital purposes, though, correct? I mean, he made a decision then. Well, it doesn't matter. Go ahead with your argument. It doesn't matter.
I think if you take a non-marital property and you apply it to something that's marital, it's still the non-marital property stays marital if you can prove it. And that's what we did here.
I think that's the key issue here is improvements to non-marital property are presumed to be marital property unless it can be shown that it's not. So the $200,000 of improvements to the property would be presumed to be marital then. And the district court didn't even analyze that.
I don't believe that it would be presumed to be marital property because...
Well, look at the Dorweller case. The Dorweller case specifically talks about that. Actually, there are a number of cases that talk about that. That's fairly clear law. And that goes back to the issue that husband has to trace that and show that it is not. It's a burden on the husband to prove that.
Well, I don't think Dorweiler stands for the broad proposition that all improvements to a house have to automatically be determined to be marital, and it has to be calculated into the final determination of the overall marital balance.
It's a presumption. It's a presumption.
Well, whether it's a presumption or not, I guess I read the case to the Faust case and the Anton case that opposing counsel cites. I did not read those to stand for that broad proposition. It can be considered.
Well, I think that on the Faust case, I'm not sure if you properly cited the Faust case because in there it says specifically that sums expended for improvements are property attributable to the party's joint efforts and constitute marital property, and it cites to the statute 518.54 subdivision 5. So Faust, I think, does stand for the proposition that it would be considered marital property.
Well, I think that when you're going to the increase in value, but they buy a property for $535 over a period of 19 years, it goes up to $650. Right now there's an issue. The other side is claiming that the property increased in value because of the improvements. And we claim that it improved because it's the market forces. We have an appraiser who looked at who understood the improvements and did not, neither side provided evidence, including their expert appraisals, that the improvements were what caused the increase in value of the property. So if Mr. Benjamin had a non-marital interest in it, simply because he used some other funds to make improvements in the property, doesn't by itself create a marital interest based on those improvements. Because if you can, people put improvements all the time in the houses that don't increase the value of the house. And we have that is what we have here. But more importantly, like I said, you have Mr. Benjamin has almost 300,000 of his $505,000 that came into the joint account that he didn't walk away with after payoff of the mortgage, that he doesn't walk away with for his non-marital property. So I think that by itself overcompensates or outweighs the issue of dealing with the alleged increase in value of the property due to the improvements. But there was no, the district court did not clear, the finding of the value was not clearly erroneous. And that's what the appellant has to prove, is that the district court's finding on that fact was clearly erroneous.
Where does the court find that the value of the house at $650,000, that it would have been, that it would had nothing to do with the improvements? I mean, isn't it just a matter of logic that if you don't maintain a house and it's in bad condition, it's going to be worth less?
Well, I don't think the issue here was it a bad condition. I think the issue.
No, I'm just saying where in the record is that A, does the court conclude that the improvement, I mean, I guess that's the question. I'm sorry for taking up some of your time here, but where in the record does the court conclude that the improvements did not contribute to the valuation of the house when it was valued?
I don't
know. Is there a finding to that effect?
I don't know that there's a specific finding to that exact effect, but I will say the court was aware of the improvements. It found the value to be $650,000. Ms. Benjamin does not challenge on appeal the finding of $650,000 on appeal. She is just trying to argue on appeal, not disregarding the standard on appeal. She's trying to argue that the court's finding in that regard was clearly erroneous. She's making an assumption that the improvements should be considered as far as the value, and she argued to that the value should be more, but she's not assigning an error to the $650,000.
So can I ask just one more really quick question? And that is the $200,000 in improvements. Is it husband's claim that that is all traceable, or that husband traced all of that to non-marital assets?
I'd have to check the dates of it. I don't recall.
Okay. Thanks.
Yes.
Thank you. I see that your time has expired, sir. Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Boulet, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to begin by returning Judge Reyes to your question, because I don't think I answered it particularly well. There is no dispute that no matter what this court decides on appeal, Mr. Bieniemann is going to walk away a millionaire with the vast majority of his inheritance intact. That is not the issue in dispute. The dispute really are both a legal question and a factual question that make a really substantial difference to Ms. Bieniemann. The home improvement issue alone would double the property settlement she received completely, just by taking that $200,000 in marital improvements and putting them in the marital column instead of the non-marital column. It's a very big deal for her. So you're absolutely right, Judge. I don't mean to confuse the notion that Mr. Bieniemann received an inheritance. He will walk away with that inheritance. But what's significant about this legal issue, particularly with respect to homestead improvements, is that the court is absolutely right. Dorweiler stands for a very clear proposition, and it's a legal proposition. And on page 576 of Dorweiler, the court says that to appropriately calculate a non-marital interest, we have to subtract the cost of repair and improvements from the home's current value. I've got Dorweiler up in front of me, so I'm reading. The cost of repairs and improvements must be subtracted from the current value of a house in order to determine the increase of value of the property due solely to appreciation. So counsel is trying to foist onto Ms. Bieniemann a burden she never had. It is not her job to prove how much the home increased as a result of these improvements. Dorweiler says we begin with the cost, and we back that cost out. I also, Judge Siegel, want to come to your question during counsel's argument, because there seems to be the suggestion that these improvements to the home were made with non-marital money. They were not. The improvements to the home were made with marital money. And we know that for a couple of reasons. We know that because many of the improvements were made before Mr. Bieniemann received his inheritance. We know that because the party's checking account, before any inheritance was received, had over $200,000 in it with which these repairs could be made. And we know that because Mr. Bieniemann himself testified that while $21,000 of the improvements may have, and I believe he used the word may, paid for with his non-marital money, there's no dispute that the bulk of these improvements, you know, at least $180,000 then, by that math, would have been marital. That issue is undoubtedly before the district court and is undoubtedly before this court. Ms. Bieniemann showed up at trial, and her entire argument was this house is marital property. It's marital property because things were commingled. It's marital property because we did all these things together. She stomped her feet as loudly as she reasonably could to make the district court aware it needed to make appropriate findings on this issue. Now, on appeal, we've raised a number of questions, right? We've raised the three legal questions about the improvements to the home funded with marital money. Raised a question about the appreciation on the home that is passive and that under Antone should have been apportioned between marital and non-marital. And we have raised the issue of reinvested income, which Judge Ray, as you rightly point out, was not made specific at the court below. But there are also a number of factual issues here. And to the extent we delve into those, it's important to remember a lot of these claims were not supported by the record below, right? Mr. Bieneman claimed to have purchased houses with funds from the sale of other homes that had not yet sold. We can see from basic arithmetic that...
And Mr. Boulay, if I may stop you there, and I think you're referring to the deeds showing the purchase of the homes. I actually want to, your time is short, so I want to run. You mentioned three issues. You did not mention a fourth issue, which you did raise in the briefs, and that is whether the district court abuses discretion by failing to allocate some of the non-marital property to wife. Are you waiving that issue now, or?
We are not waiving that issue. I think it's important, Judge Reyes, because I think it goes to your very first question, which is, counsel, is it really fair to say it's 96-4 when in most cases parties will leave with their non-marital property? We raise that issue because if all of the court's findings could be sustained, if there are no violations of law, if there are all the findings of fact are supported by the record evidence below, then it is our position in the alternative that the court erred by not apportioning non-marital property. That on these facts, with the health issues, with an international relocation, with 20 years spent in service to home and family, that if all of these non-marital claims can pass muster, it would be an abuse of discretion to leave Ms. Bieneman where she's been left.
However, so is it fair to say that's more an alternative argument to the first three then?
I would agree with that, Judge Reyes. Okay. And I would agree that it's, in some ways it's cumulative. I don't mean cumulative. In some ways it is global in the sense that courts can avoid the inequity that requires undue hardship through a number of avenues, attorney's fees, maintenance, division of non-marital findings. But if none of those things occur, then it needs to reassess in light of all the other equitable factors. And I see my time's expired, so thank you.
Judge Frisch, if I may ask just one follow-up question.
Of course.
Thank you. And this is a follow-up question to that. Can you cite to a case where we have, where an appellate court has reversed a district court for failing to grant a spouse more non-marital assets, which is what that claim is?
Right. And you're 100% right, Judge Reyes, I cannot. And not through lack of diligence or searching. That it is undoubtedly an abuse of discretion. This court would be reviewing an exercise of discretion that does lie soundly within the district court. And we would say that the extreme nature of these facts would create an abuse of discretion. And again, if the court doesn't find appropriate grounds to reverse as a legal matter on the non-marital claims and correct the amount of maintenance and the award of attorney's fees.
All right. Anything else from the panel? Counsel, thank you very much for your submissions.